Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, and welcome to the Australian and New Zealand Studies channel on the New Books Network. My name is Bede Haynes, and this morning I'm speaking with Alastair Patton, who has written a book called Of Marsupials and Men, published by Black Ink in Australia. Alastair is a journalist and an author, but he's a journalist at the moment working for News Corporation in Melbourne. I would like to welcome him to the show. Good morning, Alastair.
Hi, Bede. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. Now, could you begin by letting us know how you came to write this book?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a long story. I guess as a child, I was always interested in nature and going out on bushwalks here in Australia and trying to spot koalas in trees and things like that. And then I studied history at university and went into journalism, as you say, but history's always been a love of mine. I read a lot of history books and, of course, we're all engrossed with the big major characters in world history, but I've always been intrigued by some of the little characters you see in the background in some of those stories. And I guess with a particular nature focus from where my interest was, started digging into some of those stories and went down some really interesting and bizarre sort of rabbit holes, you might say. And yeah, uncovered all these interesting characters that really helped us understand Australia's interesting animals, and sort of I think it tells a bit of a story of how we see ourselves as Australians from when they first arrived, and you know, the British and colonists in the sort of late 1700s, and what their first reactions were, through to how we view our animals today, which I think most people, you know, they're really beloved and essentially part of our national character.
That is a sense I got from reading it. It does actually have a, as an Australian who read the book, you do get that sense of just how the relationship between people in Australia and the animals on the continent developed. The book has a lot of illustrations as well, which I think is great. One question I wanted to ask, and just to get your theory on this, the pictures of Australian animals seem to get better as years go on. So they start off quite poor. So it's when someone has to first draw a kangaroo or an emu or a platypus, and then they finally start getting better. What do you think made it so difficult to draw something?
Well, I think one very practical aspect of it was that in those very early ships that came over, especially we say the first fleet, they were bringing all these convicts, and there weren't really any naturalists or trained people on the ship. So some of these early descriptions and early drawings are by someone who might be a surgeon on the ship or something like that. Obviously, people had a lot of different interests and talent. You know, your skills could range over a wide variety of areas in those days. But so that was probably one little practical area. So they were mostly probably amateurs, and that is a bit of the tale of the book in those early years, that they were really people with not much formal scientific training who just found these things interesting and decided to write about them or go and try and trap them or investigate these strange creatures. But the other thing that was really the overarching thing, which sort of the first portion of the book really looks at, is that it was just so strange and different to anything that they were used to seeing. Something like a kangaroo was just completely baffling to these English settlers especially. And I think there was a kind of a religious aspect to it, and the all tied in with the empire, and that the science was sort of starting to take off, and natural science in the early 1800s, around that time, and they thought they had a pretty good idea of what the natural world sort of looked like within it. It was all laid out by God, and you had humans at the top and then this sort of hierarchy of animals below, and you know, it was all about what animals could do that was useful to humans. So, you know, sort of domestic animals and cattle and these things were very useful, and then there were other sort of less useful animals, and then they sailed across the other side of the world and just came across all these weird creatures that didn't really fit into this picture at all. So, you know, try to figure out what was the purpose of a kangaroo or a platypus or a koala that just sort of sat in the tree all day. I think really it took them quite a while to get their heads around all that sort of thing.
Right. And with that, so the book begins with this chapter called Doing Nature's Good Work. And I understood that title as suggesting that these people are coming to Australia and they think by introducing lots of animals into the country, they're actually doing this country good. Is that what that chapter addresses? And can you talk about what was actually happening back then? We're talking in the 1800s mostly, I think.
Yeah. So it really focuses on this period. It was actually a fairly short period really in the 1850s and 60s where this idea took hold called acclimatization, where you could introduce animals from one part of the world to another part of the world where they could be used for, you know, for farming or those sort of things. But and so there were ideas in England that they could get, you know, gazelles and things over from Africa and that they would, you know, provide food for the population there. But when it came to Australia, it was sort of tied in with this idea of that the animals here were just sort of weird and useless, and they were, you know, sort of morally deficient in some weird way. So we could improve things by bringing over, you know, better animals from other countries. So, you know, and we know what the effects of that have been over the years with things like foxes and rabbits that got introduced to Australia that have, you know, devastated the natural landscape, and we still have to deal with those today. But there were some other, you know, weird and wonderful theories that they had that, you know, there were suggestions of introducing monkeys into the parks in Melbourne or boa constrictors that would, you know, provide some entertainment for people when they went for a stroll in a park or something like that. I think yaks were on the list at one stage that some of those, thankfully, didn't quite come off. But, yeah, it only lasted probably 5 or 10 years. But, yeah, there's a lot of long-term damage that we're still dealing with.
And why do you think the people who introduced these animals didn't, or maybe they did they actually think this could be a bad idea? Why did they not? They're scientists. You would have thought that would have been something that might have occurred to them, that you can't just go and...
Yeah. You would, but I don't think it really did occur to them at all. I mean, I think their view of nature was, you know, very different to what we see it today, and, you know, they liked things to be very orderly and, for all the animals to sort of have a purpose, and I don't think they really considered all the negative implications, although it didn't take too long for something like the rabbit, once that got out of control, to realise that, you know, that probably wasn't going quite as well as what they thought when they, you know, we thought we'll just release a few rabbits that we can go hunting for. That's a good worthwhile pursuit for people to do on their weekends and so on, because they were quite worried about, you know, young people might go to a coffee house or gambling or something really, you know, morally questionable like that. So much better that they be outside in a garden with some monkeys swinging in the trees to provide them with some entertainment, or go on a hunt. And, you know, hunting in a echidna or something is not very exciting, so we'll release some foxes or deer or rabbits for those kind of activities. And I mean, thankfully the Victorian Acclimatisation Society, which was the biggest one in Australia and, you know, one of the biggest in the world, but it evolved eventually into basically what became the Melbourne Zoo. Like, their initial collection, they decided they had this holding area where they were keeping all these animals, and then they thought, well, maybe we could actually open this to the public, and it evolved in, you know, took a while, but got to, you know, thankfully now we have a zoo. So some good things have come out of it, but, I don't, you know, they call themselves scientists, but as I say, there wasn't a lot of formal scientific training going on, and, you know, one thing I mentioned is that, you know, the scientific, science was only just getting formalised as to what we know it today, but the idea of the scientific method, you know, Newton's ideas were pretty well established by that time, and they didn't really follow any of that to the letter. It was just let all the animals go and see what happens, rather than, you know, there was no follow-up to see what kind of impact they were having.
Mm. The next movement that seems to happen in our embryonic white Australia back then is animals start being transported all over the world for sale and just shipped out. And some of the figures that you supply in the book, for example, you say that the there's an article you refer to in the Register, a South Australian newspaper, describes ships with up to 30,000 parrots departing on a regular basis with 400-gallon drums of seed to feed them, destined for zoos and private collections and all the sorts of things. That sounds, well, a couple of things I'd like you to comment on. It sounds, again, and this is, I suppose, a common feature of humanity, that the animals seem to get the worst end of the deal whenever we come across them. But, and secondly, it's, what was the purpose of such massive movement of animals?
Well, yeah, I think your first point is accurate, and that's pretty sort of quick one to answer. That is true. And one thing I tried to look into, which is it's hard to find too much information because they didn't, as you say, the animals weren't the main consideration, but trying to get a bit of a sense of how hard that was to actually, you know, you see these numbers and it's just crazy, and trying to picture, you know, what are the logistics of how do you feed all these animals on a journey that might take a few months from one side of the world to the other. And, you know, part of the calculation with the huge numbers was that you kind of knew that a lot of them weren't going to make it. So the more you put on the ship, you know, the better chance you had that enough would get to the other side that would be useful. But it is a kind of a, and I found it interesting that at the same time as these British settlers who were moving to Australia thinking the animals here aren't much good, we need to bring, you know, more European animals that we're used to over here, that they were sending Australian animals back the other way because they were found in England and in Europe and America to be, you know, a real curiosity. And there was a sort of you know, these menageries and zoos and things were starting to come together, travelling sideshows, these kinds of things. But it was sort of an odd time in London in particular, which I've probably looked at the most, where you could go into a menagerie in Piccadilly or the East End and just buy yourself a flamingo or a kangaroo, or like you say, there's a description in there of one of these sort of warehouses on the East End near the docks there where the ships would unload from the other side of the world, bringing all kinds of things from, you know, the New World back to London. And there would be dealers there trying to get their hands on, you know, what have they come back with, something quirky and interesting that we might be able to sell. And yeah, if you were well enough off in London, you could go down and purchase any of these kind of animals. And, you know, there were Aboriginal artifacts and things as well in those sort of collections and, you know, coming off the ships. But yeah, there's a description of someone opening it, being led in upstairs to a room, and they described it as like, you know, a jet engine kind of style. Well, I suppose it wouldn't have been a jet engine at that stage, but maybe a locomotive or something. It's this huge cacophony of sound, and when they open the door, there's just thousands and thousands of parrots that have been, you know, sort of trying to imagine how you would get them off the ship and then, you know, shove them in the room and shut the door behind them. But yeah, you know, and those sort of birds were quite popular in English households at that time.
Mm. Now, sticking with birds, I'd like you to comment on a man you introduced into the book, a man called John Gould, who was around in the 1800s, who has a lot to do with birds. He seemed to do some scientific things. He wrote a book called The Birds of Australia, where he tried to write this massive book. He seems to have done some excellent illustrations of animals. He also seems to have liked to shoot birds. And one comment I'll pass to you after this is, he has this comment where he finds this bird, these, I don't know what they were, some birds in the bush somewhere, and he says, they're so remarkably tame that any number of shots may be fired among them without causing the slightest alarm but to any of those that are actually wounded. Is it the way he describes these sort of birds? So how do you sort of paint a picture of this man and how all these elements come together in him?
Yeah, well, John Gould is a really interesting character and one of the sort of giant figures of Australian early natural science, I guess. And he was a prominent naturalist and bird expert in London. And you know, one of the really interesting things that he did there was that he examined the finches that Charles Darwin brought back from his big worldwide expedition on the Beagle. And he was sort of one of the first ones to point out that these different finches from the different islands in the Galapagos had slightly different beaks, and you know, put sort of Darwin thinking about, well, what would cause that, and then, you know, down the track to sort of the idea of natural selection and evolution, which he sort of published, you know, 10 or 20 years after that. But then John Gould actually was supposed to write up the natural sort of descriptions from Darwin's voyage, but he decided that he actually put that plan on hold because he had a better kind of business proposition, because he was very into birds, but he was also a very shrewd sort of a businessman. And his wife, her brothers, I think, actually had moved to Australia and had a property in the Hunter Valley. And this sort of opened his eyes to the possibility of there's this whole continent with all these birds that nobody's really catalogued, and there could be a real business opportunity there for him to do that. So he came to Australia, and he was only here for about 18 months from September 1838 to April 1840. And in that time, he did capture and catalogue thousands of Australian birds. And yeah, I think that was something that he just really thought was fantastic, that he could wander down the main street of Adelaide and there were all these birds everywhere, because they were not really accustomed to really people being around, so they weren't afraid of humans, so they'd all just sit out on the main street, and he could just fire at a branch that had 50 birds on it, and the birds that weren't hit didn't really realise what was going on, so they just sort of hung around. Because that was the sort of thing that's hard for us to get our head around now. Is that I think John Gould would have considered himself to be a bird lover and a naturalist and a scientist, but to catalogue the birds, which is what was his main aim, meant shooting them. And there was sort of quite an art to doing that, to being able to stalk up. When these, that's why some of these places were a bit easier. But, he would go out into the bush with feathers on his hat and all this sort of thing and sneak through the bush and try and shoot the birds, so then that he could study them properly and, measure them and write about them, and then put them in a sort of a pickle them and put them in a jar and send them back to London. So that was kind of his whole operation. And it's quite ironic that there's the John Gould League is an Australian bird lovers sort of society, which I remember when I was at primary school, they had the Gould League posters on the wall with all the different birds. And they actually have a pledge. If you sign up to the Gould League as a child, the pledge is, "I hereby promise that I will protect native birds and not collect their eggs. I also promise that I will endeavour to prevent others from injuring native birds and destroying their eggs." But John Gould himself didn't bother him at all that he would just raid birds' nests and steal their eggs or shoot them even in their nest, which was, even at that time, was considered quite unsportsmanlike.
And what was that? Was that a school in the country that you, for the John Gould?
Oh, no, I was in Melbourne. So, I suppose it probably is. Maybe people in the country might be more familiar with it. But, I wasn't a member of the John Gould Society, but I do remember those posters that we had just with all, the different types of Australian birds. And they put out a lot of those posters that sort of are used in schools across Australia.
Now, the bird chapter also introduces Amalie Dietrich, a German lady who I'll ask you to speak about her, but before that, was it hard to find? It seems to have been dominated by, I imagine, sort of gouty middle-aged men running around shooting animals.
Yes.
Was it hard to find a lady doing something like having any history on the public record of being involved in cataloguing what was seen in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, 100% it was dominated by men. And like that picture you describe, if there's a picture of John Gould in the book, it is just absolutely as you would imagine him, like the sort of portly, middle-aged, guy with a big mutton chop sideburns and, in that sort of Victorian England sort of look. So it is mostly men, but there were a few women as well. And it was always a bit of a find when I came across an example of a woman who was out doing some of these things, and it generally wasn't as sort of socially acceptable. And Amalie Dietrich is a really interesting character because she was she was known as the little German woman, and I think she, through her whole life, didn't really worry too much about what other people thought of her, and her appearance was often commented on, which I suppose is we're sort of hopefully starting to get away from that, but it has been going on forever for women when they're sort of trying to venture into a more male-dominated field. But she was active mainly in Queensland and was out collecting for German museums. And she just collected an enormous amount of Australian animals and all kinds of bizarre things. Like she would send back shiploads of with crates of again, like I say, these sort of pickled animals, but there'd be stick insects or different types of wood, and just the list just goes on and on for all the crazy things that she collected. So I think there was a quote that in a museum said that she rivaled the great John Gould for her contribution to what we know about Australia's history. And I think we'll get into some talk about snakes soon, but she found a snake which was later catalogued as the Queensland taipan, which had quite a big influence in Australian history. And then this story that I've written, so she was doing that, and there were I think she took a stuffed koala back to Germany and crocodiles and all kinds of things. But that chapter does also touch on some of the darker aspects of this story I talked about earlier, where you know, Aboriginal artifacts were sort of souvenired and sent back with the Australian animals early on, and she certainly played a role in that. And there's a really disturbing story, really, where she was staying with a family in Queensland and reportedly asked one of the servants, "Oh, would you be able to shoot an Aboriginal man for me so I can take his, you know, have a specimen, basically?" And hopefully, we don't think that actually happened, but yeah, it sort of is an example of some of the thinking that went on, that the, you know, when Australian animals were starting to be seen as something really interesting and worth studying, that Indigenous people were classed in a similar kind of category. And you know, and some Indigenous people ended up, you know, from Australia, were coerced into travelling overseas and ended up in some of these travelling menageries in America and Europe as well. So, yeah, some pretty, really, yeah, that's like the book, I think, is hopefully a nice, you know, breezy sort of pacey read that has a lot of interesting, quirky, you know, funny stories, but there are some, you know, dark aspects of it as well that I think it's important to shine a light on.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the that incident asking to shoot the Indigenous person. It looks like it didn't happen, which is probably good. Obviously, it's good, but it seems as though the reason that it might not have happened was because there might have been a moral objection. But I wondered if there was some suggestion that it was that was sort of, if the person that wanted to do it, they could have done it without any sort of legal concern. It seems very, very serious thing to suggest, but who would even suggest that if it wasn't legal? So do you have any idea if that was the kind of done thing almost?
I mean, you could go down a whole another dark path on that. But in that, you know, in the 1800s in Australia, you know, a lot of Aboriginal people were shot, unfortunately. And I think, you know, it can be a bit of a complicated story, but which I'm actually reading a lot about at the moment. But I think technically they were sort of British subjects, so they were subject to, you know, protected by the law. But in practice, and especially unfortunately probably in Queensland worse than anywhere, it really was people just looked the other way. So, yeah, there were a couple of high-profile – there was one very high-profile trial in New South Wales where some white people were hanged eventually for the a massacre of a large number of Aboriginal people. But basically, you know, that was really a very rare example of that ever happening, of people being brought to justice. And really, unfortunately, that just sort of – the message that sent was that you just try and don't – you know, we just do this on the down low now and we don't talk about it as quite as openly as we used to, but it definitely still happens. So, yeah, I mean, that little tale in the book here doesn't really go into all that, but it does sort of hint at that, I guess, that, yeah, the fact that someone would even suggest it with, you know, sort of knowing that, oh, I could probably do it without being punished, says quite a lot, unfortunately.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. Now, the next chapter is about snakes. One thing I liked about this chapter was if you start from the back and you think at the moment if someone gets bitten by a snake in Australia, you would hope that they have some sort of anti-venom around to help the person recover. And this chapter, in a way, starts from the beginning and just shows what effort was taken to get to the point where you do have that medicine available. Could you just comment a little bit on that chapter and I mean, I don't want to give away too many of the stories in it. So I'll let you, if you want to divulge any of the tales in it, you can. I'll leave it up to you because it's just worth reading in full.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, the story does have a bit of a charts the history of, you know, the development of those, you know, Australians and their relationship with the animals. And by sort of the turn of the 20th century, getting into the 1900s, attitudes had evolved quite a bit, and a lot of the Australian animals were being more appreciated and had been studied, and people knew a lot more about them. But snakes were probably the one that were really left till last, because going back to that initial idea about the sort of hierarchy of animals, the snakes were sort of literally at the bottom, and, you know, they were sort of seen as dangerous and you know, not very nice, and it wasn't something that people were too enthusiastic to study. But then, yeah, this sort of really propelled that around in the, you know, 1920s, around that time when it sort of started. But before that, yeah, people started to try to come up with some ways to cure snake bites. And, yeah, they came up with some pretty bizarre and creative solutions, which people can read about in the book. And then things started to get a little bit more, you know, scientific, and then, you know, air quotes, I guess you could say. And there's an illustration that's in there from the Australian Sketcher, but this is sort of going back to 1877, of an experiment in the Melbourne jail, where they started, you know, they'd use the jail and captured stray dogs in the streets of Melbourne and use them to for these unfortunate snake bite experiments, where they would get a snake to bite a dog and then inject them with all kinds of weird things, and hoping that it might save the life of the dog. But unfortunately, it never really worked. And there were some people who were so keen on these ideas that they were sort of prepared to volunteer themselves for the experiments as well, but thankfully, usually rejected, thankfully, early on there. But yeah, once we get into sort of the 1910s, 1920s, around that time, the idea of anti-venoms was sort of being developed, and vaccines and these things. Louis Pasteur had made a lot of advances in that, obviously. And then, yeah, it really sort of came to these Australian snakes were some of the last ones that we didn't have any cures for. And, yeah, I really go into the chapter there and tell a few stories of some of these people that, yeah, I just found this amazing that there were men, I think this pretty much was all men, who were prepared to and really enthusiastically, you know, put their hands up and say, we'll go out and try and capture the snakes, because they realised what they needed once the idea of an antivenom was developed. And initially they hoped one antivenom would sort of cover all the different types of snakes, but once they discovered that wasn't the case, you would have to go and capture an individual type of a particular snake to be able to milk them to get the venom to develop an antivenom for that snake. So the taipan is the one that, you know, I probably spent most time talking about as a reference with Emily Dietrich. And trying to capture a taipan, which just seems just a crazy idea in itself, and to then milk it to create a life-saving antivenom, which that all did happen, but it was sort of an amazing saga how many attempts and how they actually got hold of one. And then it had to get transported to Melbourne, where it was milked and, you know, ends up saving a lot of lives. But it was just an incredible story, and, you know, a few people did die along the way.
Now, Alistair, if you have your book in front of you, I'm not sure if you do. But
I do, yes.
I won't give it away, but I just want to, and this is hopefully people go and look at the book to see these points. But I love on page 147, your idea for footnote 14.
Let me find that. Oh, right. Yes.
That was, I won't give that away. It's worth experiencing.
Easter egg for people to go and look up. Yes. Reaction on reading what that's describing.
And also on page 151, the name of the tortoise, I think it's very, that you're just reporting on that name, but I thought that was good as well.
Oh, which one was that, sorry? Oh, the joy. Yeah, that's right. Well, that was, yeah, I mean, that was sort of part of the joy of writing the book, that, you know, you're finding these interesting characters and you're reading about them in various different sources, in old newspapers or old, you know, some of them wrote books or kept journals and these sort of things. And there'd just be little anecdotes or things like that you just jump out and have a laugh and think, right, that's got to go in the book. It's just something a bit odd that doesn't, it adds to the story because it tells you a bit about that person, but, you know, it's just something that I thought needed to go in.
And these days, do people still have to milk snakes to get to do this work?
Yeah, no, that definitely still happens. I think it's a little bit more, organised and formal process now. It's a bit more ad hoc back then and there. So that's sort of, I guess, the story of the book is these amateur scientists who helped us learn about the animals. And the first snake experts were, you know, it was really rough and ready stuff out in the field. But I think probably, you know, the Commonwealth Serum Laboratories and places like that. And I think the Australian Reptile Park in Gosford, New South Wales, which I tell Eric Worrell, the guy who founded that, and he was sort of one of the real pioneers in this snake milking. I think they still do quite a lot there as well. But, probably a bit more it's a bit of a safer process now than it used to be. But still, I wouldn't be volunteering for it.
Mm. You have a chapter on platypuses. Well, I'm not sure if that's a plural, platypuses or something else, but there's a whole chapter on them. And it's, again, full of interesting facts. One of the things that I found amazing, which I'd like you to comment on, is there seems to still be a lot that people don't know about the platypus. It seems a very mysterious animal back then and still.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And, I mean, that even ties into what you're just saying about the platypuses. I mean, there's sort of no official formal agreement on what the plural of a platypus is. Some people say platypi, or I found an online petition of people saying, let's call them platypodes. But I think I went with platypuses. I think that makes the most sense. But yeah, you're right. I mean, and, you know, they get their own chapter devoted to them because they were so mysterious and so hard to study and hard to understand. And there was a lot of scientific debate about, you know, what sort of animal they actually were, where do they fit into the animal kingdom, and, you know, they have some qualities that are like a mammal, but some that are more like a reptile, and some that are, you know, even like aquatic. So, and the big question that took a long time to resolve was, you know, do they lay eggs? There's, you know, big two sides of this scientific debate, and so people went out to try and find platypuses, and unfortunately, again, a lot of them got shot in the process of trying to, you know, decide do they lay eggs or not. David Flay, who was also the guy who milked that taipan, he comes in and out of the story quite a bit, was a real giant in this field of, you know, in all natural history in Australia, really. For people in Australia and Melbourne who know Healesville Sanctuary, he was really the guy who founded that and turned it into what we know it today. It's one of their great natural animal sort of attractions here that people love. But he really was, and platypuses live in that area up around Healesville and in the creeks up there, and he was able to trap a few and keep them in captivity and really study them. And when he was able to breed a platypus in captivity for the first time in 1943, and that really made worldwide headlines, and it didn't happen again for another 60 years. So, I mean, the fact that up until I think it was 2018 or 19, there were no platypuses in overseas zoos at all. I think there's a couple now in San Diego. Just illustrates, you know, how hard they are to transport and how little understood really they still are, because they're just a very shy animal that, you know, if you manage to see one in the wild, it's extremely special moment, because they spend a lot of their time in their burrows or underwater. But yeah, they have all these amazing talents, you know, electro sensors in their bills that can detect shrimps, you know, wriggling under the mud in the bottom of the creek, and, you know, poisonous spurs on their hind legs and all kinds of weird things. So after researching all the book, people ask me, you know, what's your favorite animal, and I have to say the platypus, because it's just so incredible and still so interesting that there's still, you know, a lot to learn about them.
Yeah, the have you ever come across one in the wild yourself?
Yeah, just a couple of times, really, probably the couple of times fleeting, you know, a few bubbles in a creek. But a couple of years ago, I was hiking in Tasmania, and there's one. It was just seemed to be really enjoying itself at the base of a waterfall. It would swim in and out of the water there, and then sort of sit on a rock and scratch itself. And that was just one of my favorite experiences out in the wild. Just sitting there watching it for, you know, sort of a good half hour or so. That was a real standout.
Okay, the a later chapter toward the end of the book talks about marsupials in the media, and this is great for people who, I suppose, a lot of people who grew up in Australia, because you go through the history, it's almost a little history of wildlife media. And what role have you seen the media play in either the exploitation of these animals or the conservation of these animals?
Yeah, I really enjoyed writing this chapter, and I'm exactly as you described. I really grew up watching some of these documentaries and, you know, some of these characters on TV who really became high profile Australian celebrities. You know, sort of people might obviously know Steve Irwin is the most recent example, but I'm talking about going back into the, 10, 20, 50 years ago, and sort of the early days of TV. And then even the chapter starts with people before the modern media was around, and they were writing books and newspaper columns and then into the radio and how it sort of really took off. But I think they played a huge role in just bringing that wildlife literally into the, well, we can see it in our living rooms, and making it, you know, like I say, that journey that we've come from these animals being weird and unnatural to now they're really beloved. And Australians, you know, even if Australians might not see a platypus in the wild too often, you know, we all know and love them because, and a lot of it I think is we can attribute to some of these guys, even though they were a bit rough around the edges. I think, yeah, their heart was definitely in the right place. And thankfully by then we had definitely moved on from the early era where, you know, finding an interesting bird meant that you had to shoot it and pickle it. They were much more about, sneaking through the bush and maybe lifting up a piece of bark and seeing what was under there. But, I really enjoyed those TV documentaries and TV shows in my youth and growing up. And, hopefully some of that comes across. And I found it really interesting to dig into the stories of some of these people and where they came from and what they were about.
Yeah, they talk about the Taylors, Valerie Taylor and Ron Taylor, and sharks. The sharks don't play a big role in this book, but sharks are in a lot of people's minds in Australia. You hear a lot about sharks whenever someone gets bitten by a shark. How would you describe their importance toward shark conservation?
Oh, I mean, just enormous. Yeah. So Ron and Valerie were a married couple who. Unfortunately, Ron's no longer with us, but Valerie still is, and she's still out diving. And they met in Sydney, and I think sort of in the 1950s, 60s, around that time, and started filming. I think Ron had an underwater camera, and they were able to get their films shown. And they were, bought in America and other countries, and they quickly discovered that, sharks were what people wanted to see. You know, we still see Shark Week on TV. People are really fascinated by sharks. So they started filming a lot of sharks, and they were involved in some sort of hired to work on some big productions of movies, including Jaws. So some of the scenes in the movie Jaws that you see of sharks actually swimming in the wild, where they're real sharks and not the pretend ones, Australian sharks in South Australian waters filmed by the Taylors. And then it was sort of the reaction to some of those movies where people, Jaws came out and obviously it was this enormous hit, and people really turned against sharks and thought sharks were terrible, and the Taylors didn't really understand. They just thought, it was a piece of entertainment and they enjoyed filming it, but they were sort of really taken aback by the reaction and how, sharks became this real villain. And so they turned their attention to conservation and, trying to educate people about sharks and really, it's a bit like the snakes, it takes a particular type of person, I think, to be that enamored with them as they were. And there's some bizarre stories to my mind of Valerie saying how sharks are just totally misunderstood and they're really cuddly creatures, but at the same time she's had experiences where she's nearly have lost limbs and things like that when filming didn't go as planned. But I think that has definitely had a huge impact, and you really see that now when there's a shark attack, which does still happen occasionally. I think the attitude, even 10, 20 years ago, was really the automatic response was for the authorities to go out and find this shark and kill it, basically, as a, retaliation, and to, try and, make sure it didn't do it again. But, that was sort of based on this weird idea that, once sharks were out to try and hunt people. But now I think people see that the shark is in its natural environment. And I think I quote a guy in the book who was attacked by a shark near Perth in the last couple of years. And he said, his quote was, you can't blame a shark for being a shark. So I think people have a much greater understanding of them. And yeah, we can definitely thank the Taylors for a lot of that.
Okay. So we should wind down now. So as a last question I'd like to ask is, the book ends talking about the importance of ensuring we have healthy populations of native animals. And one of the points you make is that researchers estimate it would cost $1.6 billion to return all Australian threatened species to healthy status. And then you imagine the reader thinking, wow, well, you know, almost, why would we ever do that? But then you make the point that we already spend $12 billion a year on domestic pets. So it's actually $1.6 billion isn't actually that much. But you're writing a book where you're actually really pleading for this. Why do you think it is? Why is it so hard to get money spent on conserving animals?
I think one thing that I found quite interesting, and I sort of tried to paint this picture in the book, is that it's just really hard when people see, if you can go out in the bush and you might likely enough to see a koala, you know, platypuses are pretty elusive anyway. A lot of our animals are, you know, nocturnal and elusive, and it's very hard just to comprehend. You know, you sort of think, well, there's animals out there, they must be doing all right, to really realise how many there used to be compared to what there are now. And, like, you know, koalas are now endangered in Queensland and New South Wales and the ACT, and I think there's about 40,000 koalas left in Australia. And 40,000 even sort of sounds like a reasonable number, but then you realise that there were millions of koalas that were killed just for their skins in, you know, when we had a sort of a fur industry, you know, 100 years ago. So, you know, there used to be millions of koalas in the, you know, in the bush, and now there's, you know, only 40,000. So, yeah, it's sort of, hopefully I can try to get that across. And there's a great description of, you know, whales that some of the early explorers, when they were, you know, sailing into, you know, Hobart, for example, they said it was actually quite dangerous sailing up the river because there were so many whales that the, you know, ship was sort of trying to dodge them as it came in. And now, you know, if you go out on a whale watching expedition and happen to see one, you know, that's a real treat. So, yeah, it's just sort of hard for us to get our head around how many animals there were back in those days. And so, you know, what the fall, you know, the comparison is now to what it was back then. And is the concern is that the numbers just keep dropping without people really realizing until it gets a point where it's, you know, almost too late. I just think that would be an absolute tragedy if, you know, something like the koala would be just, I can't imagine having a, you know, me living or having my kids live in a country where, you know, we have to say we used to have koalas and we don't have them anymore. I mean, that just would be absolutely tragic. And, you know, obviously a koala is a very high profile example, but there's lots of others that are, you know, really in trouble as well. So that's probably the easiest explanation, that it's, you know, someone has to take, you know, and it's a government sort of thing that they have to take responsibility for saying, you know, this is an issue that's important enough for us to devote these resources to it. And one number that I found, which I found, you know, really took me by surprise, I guess, in the book, was how much they spend in the US on nature conservation and on threatened species. And they've got a similar number of sort of species to what we do, but they spend far, far more money on conserving their native animals. So, you know, sort of think, you don't really think of America as being, you know, pioneers in that sort of field, but you know, if they can do it, I can't see, you know, why we can't do it. And I think, you know, not a politics show, but I think there are some movements in the right direction recently, that some of these issues that were really neglected for a long time are starting to be at least talked about. So hopefully that leads to some positive action, because I think, you know, it would, you know, part of the story of the book is the relationship between animals and people here in Australia. And, you know, obviously I think the animals, you know, deserve to survive and for the species to continue, and for the sake of biodiversity has its own intrinsic worth. But also, you know, as a country and for us as Australians, I think it makes us a better, richer country to have these amazing animals around us that we all love. And to not have them there would be, I really would hate to see that happen.
Mm. Okay, Alistair. Well, thank you for your time. Before we go, do you have a next book in mind?
Well, the subject that we touched on earlier when you mentioned about Emily Dietrich, about the Indigenous Australians and the sort of what they suffered in this similar sort of time period, is I think something that I've been reading a lot about and I would like to write about. We'll see how we go. But they do get, you know, I tried not to leave them out of this story, because obviously, you know, they were here for thousands and tens of thousands of years before the Europeans arrived. But this book is really mainly about European settlers and what their attitudes were, and they were sort of the naturalists and scientists who generated a lot of these stories. But I do try and touch on the Indigenous perspectives in it as well. But I think there's a bit of a gap there that we don't talk a lot about. I feel like it's being more recognised now that if you go somewhere, say, for instance, as a tourist, they'll talk about the history and the ancient human history of, you know, the indigenous people who owned the land originally. And then we talk about the Europeans arrived, and then this is what happened after that. And it's sort of that crossover period we don't really like to talk about too much. It's like, how did we get from there to here, and what happened to the people who were there originally? And it's, yeah, it's pretty, some of the stories of reading are pretty incredible about, you know, they didn't just melt away into the bush. There was some pretty fierce fighting that went on that really, I think, is an important part of Australian history that probably doesn't get talked about enough. So, yeah, that's what I'm finding interesting to read about at the moment. And, yeah, if I get the chance, I'd love to write about it as well.
Okay, Alistair, well, thank you very much for your time again, and all the best with your next book.
Fantastic. Thank you.